you're looking for him, sorry. But my name is Wendy Schroeder, and I am a recovered alcoholic and addict.
Hey, Wendy.
Hey, y'all. And, you know, I'm here tonight because I really, really believe in this program. And I'm here because there's 10 years between my first sobriety date and my last sobriety date. And I want to tell you a little bit about that. I also want to tell you that when I look up at this board, and maybe that concerns you and maybe it doesn't, but I see all these people with 30 days, 60 days, 90 days. What do you see happening here? By the time you get to 1 year, alcohol hasn't changed, drugs haven't changed, right? Shitty day at work is still a shitty day at work. Rotten spouses are rotten spouses. You know, snotty-nosed kids are snotty-nosed kids. How come people are dropping off into oblivion? I feel it's because we don't carry the message and we don't talk about the precise instructions in this book. And I really, like I said, I really believe in it because, you know, I sat in meetings and I laughed and I went to the meetings after the meetings and I did a lot of stuff and I worked my program. My program didn't work, but this program does. So I'll tell you a little bit about myself. Jason, I'm only drunk for 10 minutes, right? Okay. I was born in a Midwestern town where everyone made your business their business. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I was in trouble by the time I got home for something that I just pulled off downtown, breaking windows or stealing cars, right? I'm already in trouble. I don't even have enough time to formulate my excuses. I came from a home where both parents are adult children of alcoholics. So alcohol was not served except at special occasions. And even then, if some adult left their glass unattended, I was over there to sneak a drink. I loved the way it felt. I loved the way it burned. There was something magic about it, right? Now in high school, I went to parties and I saw the way these kids acted when they were drunk. And they were crazy and out of control. But you know, something did happen for them because, you know, the next day, you know, Monday rolled around and everybody's talking about them and how crazy they were and how funny they were and they laughed. And you know, I really wanted that because I was an average student. I wasn't, you know, too popular or well known. And I tucked that somewhere in the back of my mind and I held on to that. And after high school, my dad said to me, you have 3 days to get ready for college. And I'd never considered college before, to be honest, because like I said, I'm an average student and I hated school and I wasn't good at it. But he told me that I was going off to school and to get ready. So I get to school and I'm scared to death. You know what I'm saying? People scare the shit out of me. Because, you know, I don't know what to talk about. I don't know how to act. So first night away at college, I'm invited to a trash can party, you know, where they mix all the booze together. And I drank. Because, again, that's what the cool kids did, and everyone talked about them, and I could be the big gal on campus, and I was. But I came to out of a, and I was a blackout drinker from the get-go. I that's how I drank. Never called my numbers, never did. And I came to the next morning, handcuffed to my sweet mate's bed in somebody else's clothes, and I'm like, why, first of all, why am I handcuffed to this bed? And what am I wearing? And they said, well, we were playing truth or dare, and we dared you to run through the student service building wearing shaving cream, and you did. So we were just worried what somebody might dare you to do, and you'd do, and I would have. And you know, that was the craziness. That was just me. But again, I got the attention I so desperately wanted. So let's fast forward a little bit. I'm a sophomore in college now, and I meet the man of my dreams. Ladies, can you relate to the guy who's going to take you away and save you from yourself? You know? I mean, this was him. And he and I agreed to drop out of school to take our tuition and to take all that money and travel around the world. Because clearly, I'm going to be a different person when I get there. Right? Yeah. You know, Bill talks about all the unhappy scenes in his apartment with Lois. And it was unhappy wherever Chris and I went. We'd get drunk beyond the point of recognition, and we'd get into fights, and it got very, very violent when we drank. And, you know, eventually it got to that point where it got so bad that I asked him to leave, and he did. And interestingly, he went to AA. He got sober. But, you know, I would not quit. I'm not a quitter. I kept drinking. But I can tell you at that point that my drinking took on more serious proportions. Now I'm living out in California. It says in the book that alcoholics, we do absurd and incredibly tragic things while drinking. And one of the most absurd things that I ever did was to try methamphetamines. But it did allow me to drink longer periods of time. It is part of my story, but out of AA's singleness of purpose, I'm not going to get too much off into that. But I will tell you that in Bill's story, he says, you know, I'd met my match. I was overwhelmed. You know, drugs and alcohol were my master. They told me where to go. They told me what to do and to who to do it with. I did things on methamphetamines that I swore I would never do. Those lines, those moral lines, that compass that I always had, that I said, oh, if it ever gets to this, you know, if it ever gets to this point, I'll quit. If I ever do this for drugs and alcohol, I quit. You know, and guess what? I could never, ever keep those promises. And the lines that I drew, I kept extending out further and further until eventually I had no more morals and I had no more values at all. They took that from me. And in 1994, believe it or not, I graduate with a degree in education. And I'm going off to Japan again, because that seems far away. I'm going to go there and I'm going to teach. And at this point, I decide, since the party that is college is over, I am through. I'm done. That's it. No more. You know, all my friends were growing up and moving on, and I thought it was time for me to do the same. You know, it never occurred to me that I couldn't, that I wouldn't be able to. When the time came, that I wouldn't be able to stop at all. My dad picks me up. Of course, I bought about $700 worth of dope before we leave. And we're driving in the car back across country, back to Michigan, and I'm going to put all my stuff in storage, and I'm going to accept this great job. Well, we get outside of Yuma, Arizona, and this is, I feel, where, you know, I believe that God intervenes at so many different times. You could probably look back at your drinking and using career and say, wow, that was kind of weird, wasn't it? But that person was there, or this happened, or I was protected somehow. Didn't quite associate it with a God-made coincidence, but then later on you're looking back and it makes sense. See, we're outside of Yuma, Arizona, and I'm in this old pickup truck, and the radiator breaks. And we have to drive through Albuquerque, New Mexico, which is where his younger brother lives. In fact, he manages a Toyota dealership in Albuquerque, which is what we were driving. And so he hadn't seen his brother in 17 years. In fact, you know, the way alcohol tears up families, the way addiction kind of tears up families, and there's a lot of hard feelings about, you know, different things. They had not really seen each other in 17 years, and they were cousins I hadn't, you know, seen in about that long, since I was a little bitty. So we stop into Albuquerque, and I am just a mess. I'm a mess. I've been up about 7 days, maybe, at this point. I'm covered, you know, y'all, I'm covered with sores. I got hair. My hair's coming out. I have these dark circles under my eyes, real characteristic of, you know, an alcoholic addict. The bones are poking through my, you know, my clothes, and you can see my ribs, and it was a mess. So we're sitting down to dinner, which, of course, wasn't too hungry, and my cousin walks in. And my cousin's sleeping on somebody's couch. She's telling me about it, and she doesn't have a job, but she asked me if I'd like to go down and work at A&A and answer phones with her. And I thought, well, yeah, sure, if this is a good career move for you, let me run to the bathroom real quick, and then I'll be right there. And so, well, you know, y'all, what we did was we went down to Albuquerque central office, and we answered phones. People would call in, and she was doing 12-step work. And she's talking to me, and she's talking to me about her drinking, how out of control she was with it. And she was talking to me about her love affair with crack cocaine and how she wasn't using it anymore. You know, the most amazing thing is that she had that look in her eye. There was something about her that, you know, she had no place to live. She had no income. And here again, I'm comparing all the great things that I have going on in my life to what's not going on in hers. And yet I wanted so desperately to die at this point. And you know, there was this plaque, I'll never forget it, it's a quote by C.S. Lewis, and it said, in the end of all of our travelings, we'll come back to the place we started, and we'll know it for the first time. And I came back to my home in Michigan, and there's my mom, and there's my dad, and there's my brother, and I am a stranger in my own house. You know, not only in my own skin, I'm a stranger in my own home. I didn't know these people, I didn't want to talk to them, I didn't want them to touch me, I wanted nothing to do with them. And I'd realized that all this traveling and running around was just my trying to escape me, my problem, which was me all along. And I slept for about 2 days. You know, I'd come out of my bedroom and I don't know, again, it was God put the words in my mouth that were not there. And I came out to my mom and I said, "Mom, I got a problem." And it was pretty obvious to her, but they thought I had an eating disorder. And you know, at first I was going to go with that because it's. But you know, the first time in my life I ever spoke an honest word, which was, "I need help." You know, "I need help." And that was it. I mean, we're calling and treatment centers and getting in and whatever. And I don't know about you, but I thought at the end of these 28 days and I'd had all this knowledge about myself and my disease that I would be better. That's all I needed was just a little, you know, a little rest up and a little good food in my stomach and I'd start feeling good and call some people that I knew and life would be great. But the truth is, I was miserable. You just took away the only solution that I had to living and I did not know what to do with myself. So, I mean, I'm like the man of 30 in the big book. You know, it talks about, you know, that he was going to make himself, as he was going to be successful in business, and he was going to acquire all these things. And then after 25 years, bone dry, he decides it's time to pick up a drink. He decides it's time to pick up a drug, right? And he's dead in 4 years. Well, I'm approaching 10 years with not a drug or a drink in my system. And I'm about ready to die. I'm going to meetings. But what I'm doing is, I'm not reaching out to anybody. I get a sponsor, and if my sponsor hurt my feelings, I get another one, right? I mean, working the steps, let's see. Step four, I write down my entire life story and just puke all this stuff out of my sponsor, and she's crying, and she's like, "Oh yeah, that's too bad, poor thing." You know, and that's it. That's all I got. And I went and made my amends saying I'm sorry. But I went to an amends to a guy that I owed $100 to with not a single dime in my pocket, right? You know, forget step 10 because that would require me actually calling my sponsor every day and talking to my sponsor and talking about, "Oh, I stepped in it today." You know, and I just didn't want to let anyone know me like that. I was always too busy to do an 11th step. You know, I'm one of those prayer meditation out the driveway backing up on your way late for work. "Hey, yeah, God, I'm here. Yeah." Right? And then step 12. You know, step 12 just seemed like a lot of work. Because that would require something out of me. You know? That would require me getting up off my ass and doing something. Not like it wasn't a lot of work, you know, getting high and getting drunk, right? But see, I wasn't making that comparison. So I go into a doctor's office, and like I said, almost 10 years stone cold sober, and it sounded like a really, really good idea to be put on prescription Ritalin. You know, sounded like a great idea at the time. And pretty soon that bottle that read "take one at 4 o'clock," read "take four at 1 o'clock," and then it read "take 40 a day." You know how we are, and I'm off to the races. And I come back to this group in Dallas where, for the first time, I'd actually heard something that I could grab a hold of. This crusty old man, I mean, seriously, when I say crusty, you can come up and see this picture of him that I have in the front of my big book. 83 years old, crusty old man. And he walks up to me and he goes, "You look like you're dying." And I said, "You don't know me. I'm fine." Right? Yeah. Then he breaks open the book. Well, no, he doesn't even break it open because he's got this memorized, right? And he says, "Let me ask you something on page 52. If this isn't you," he says, "are you having trouble with your personal relationships?" I'm like, "What personal relationships?" He said, "You having a hard time controlling your emotions? Are you prey to misery and depression? Do you feel useless? Do you feel unhappy?" I'm like, "Yeah, that's me." He says, "Well, that's untreated alcoholism. Welcome." Right? Now, if I take those problems to a doctor, what the hell is a doctor going to do? Here's a prescription for
Prozac.
Good luck. Yeah. Come see me in 30 days. But y'all, these things, that's a spiritual malady kicking my ass. Without anything in my system, that's us, isn't it? Isn't that us? Isn't that why we drank and used to begin with so we wouldn't have to feel that stuff? Right? Now, the other thing he explained to me, and you know, again, I'd never heard this before. I went to meetings, and I heard people with 25 years say, I am a recovering alcoholic, I'm a recovering addict. And you know, I went to my daughter's wedding, and there was a glass of wine on the table, and my wife and I had to leave. If after 25 years a glass of wine still scares you, oh my God, you have not recovered. You know, we can recover from this. If you break your leg, are you always recovering from a broken leg? No. The doctor sets a cast, the bone heals, and you can walk around. A free man. And that's what Cliff explained to me the first time I ever sat down with him, is that what I'm offering you is freedom. Freedom from active addiction, freedom from alcoholism. And you know, I'm going to use drugs and alcohol interchangeably a little bit, but let me tell you something. NA used this book from 63 to 83 without fail. Without fail. First thing he points out to me is it says, this is the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered. ED, past tense, all done. We've recovered. I don't have to avoid it. Where are you going to go out there and avoid your temptation? What are you going to do? Liquor stores? I mean, they're on every corner. How many did we pass on our way here, for God's sake? You know? Where can I possibly go where the temptation won't be there? Ain't going to happen. So if you're making your trigger list and you're thinking of all the things you're going to have to avoid and not do when you get out there, let me tell you something. I'll talk about that in just a minute, okay? But one thing he did talk to me about was this, and again, y'all, this up here scares me. He said, you know, back in the day, back in 1939, if you came to an AA meeting, two old-timers would come up to you, and they'd ask you a little bit about yourself, and they'd qualify you to make sure you're the real deal and not just a hard drinker. And yes, there is a difference. A hard drinker can quit if given good reason. An alcoholic addict cannot. Period. So these old-timers would come up and they'd qualify you and they'd ask you, are you the real deal? And if they felt that you were, they would sit you down and they would outline the program of action. We don't do that today. Oh, welcome, newcomer. Yeah, the coffee's over there. Just sit until you're, you know, keep coming back till your ass falls off. That is irresponsible of me to let a newcomer walk in here and not hear the message of hope. I'm killing people. Back in the day, you guys, our success rate was 92%. Of the people that came to AA and really tried, 50% at once, 25% knuckleheads after some relapses, and among the remainder, another 20%, 95%. You know what our success rate is today? Less than 2%. 1% of you women are actually going to make it. That scares me. And like I said, nothing's changed, y'all, except the way we carry this message. The way that we practice these principles in all of our affairs. Meetings were only so the newcomer would have a place to go, so the old-timer could grab him and say, come here, let me show you. Let's do the work. Let's get on it. That's why we believe in this. Okay, the other thing Cliff explained to me was this. He says, you know what your problem is? You know why you're powerless? You know, we read these steps all the time, don't we? We're powerless over alcohol. My life is unmanageable. I never knew what that meant. Powerlessness means that when I put drugs or alcohol in my body in any form at all, I trigger an allergy, a craving that is beyond my willpower to stop it. Yeah. Any of you have an allergy to anything? Shrimp, penicillin? Jamie, what's it to?
Oh, mine's to
alcohol. Okay, well. Okay, what's yours to?
Penicillin.
Penicillin. What happens when you put penicillin in your body? Throat closes up, find it a little hard to breathe, right? Hives. Okay, vomiting. I bet when that happened to you the very first time and the doctor told you you were allergic to penicillin, did you ever go back and repeat that experiment? Hell no, right? That's dumb. Mine's to shrimp. If I put shrimp in my body, my throat closes up, I break in a hive, my eyes swell shut, I can die from that. And guess what? First time that happened, I made the decision. I never had to manage that decision ever because I knew that's going to kill me. It's an allergic reaction. It's an abnormal reaction to anything. Nothing I can do about an allergy to shrimp, like nothing she can do about an allergy to penicillin. Well, see, the phenomenon of craving, though, our craving or our allergy is to ethanol. Ethanol is in alcohol, of course, and ethanol is also used to manufacture street drugs. Guess what? You put it in your body can't break it down because your liver and your pancreas are lacking enzymes that break it down. You produce this real funky chemical in the brainstem, THIQ, that makes it impossible for you to stop because it's the most highly addictive chemical known to man. You're screwed. And when Cliff laid that out for me, I'm like, oh my God, that makes so much sense. I can't call my numbers. One is in me. I'm going to stop at 3. 12 more later, I'm going, how did I get started again? Because I have a physical allergy to this stuff. Now, that should be easy because first time I broke out with a shrimp allergy, I stopped. You know why? Shrimp doesn't do it for me. If shrimp got me high, I'd be like down here at Carlson's Fish or Fish Market looking for shrimp, looking to score shrimp. You know where I get the shrimp? Right? I would be. You know you would be. Because it also tells me in the doctor's opinion, by the way, doctor's opinion, Dr. William Silkworth treated Bill Wilson in 1934, but he'd already seen him 3 times. He's like, God, Bill, you're gonna die. And he's the one that came up with this theory of the powerlessness over alcohol, which is now a proven medical fact. That's why this is a disease you're living with. We know it is a disease today. It's in the American Medical Journal. It's a disease. But the other real screwed up thing about it, like I said, I can manage a decision to stay away from shrimp. She can manage a decision to stay away from penicillin. We can't manage the decision to stay away from drugs and alcohol. Why? Men and women use essentially because they love the effect produced by drugs and alcohol. And that the sensation is so elusive. You're walking out of prison after doing 15 years for killing somebody. You're sleeping on a couch because your wife kicked you out and she wants nothing to do with you and you're done. You've lost your 3rd job in 3 weeks. A judge says if you do that one more time, you're going away. Right? Plenty of reasons to stop. A lot of injuries. That's not what makes my life unmanageable. It's not what makes your life unmanageable. What makes your life is unmanageable is with all those things that happen to you, and you make a resolution, a firm resolution, never to do it again. What are you doing a week later? What are you doing the same day? Yeah, exactly. You know, I'm here to tell you that at first it was fun. Oh, love drinking, love drugging. It was fun. Then it was fun with some problems. Well, towards the end, it was nothing but problems. And I'm sure it's like that for each and every one of you. You wouldn't be sitting down here in this hot-ass basement if it weren't causing some problems in your life, right? Right? Right. Oh, God, it's hot. Sorry. Okay. So, you know, I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. The book tells me that. I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. I gotta experience that sense of ease and comfort. Comes at once. Crack. Bug, 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 right? Bad day at work, whatever. It fixed every problem I ever had until it started causing more problems than it was fixing. It says step one in a nutshell. I'm powerless because I have an allergy. I'm unmanageable because I'm unable to manage a decision to stop for good and all. But the one thing I love about this book is this. In the chapter more about alcoholism, no one wants to label anyone an addict or an alcoholic, but you can diagnose yourself. It says go to the nearest bar room, try some controlled drinking, see if you can stop at 3. Wow. Try leaving it alone for a year. See how that goes. You're not batshit crazy by the end. Good luck with it, you know? But it tells you, we don't want to pronounce anyone an alcoholic or an addict. No. I'm sure you got other things to do with your life. But there's another really great questionnaire. I love that. They gave me this 100 question, did they do that here? With the, or 44 questions or whatever? Our book gives you 2. And you only need a 50% to pass this test. You only have to answer yes to one of these questions. It says, if when drinking or using, you find you cannot quit entirely. Check. Or, if when drinking and using, you have little control over the amount you take. Check. Well, I can't quit entirely because my mind can't remember. I was just spent the night in jail with someone else's puke all over me. My mind is broken. Second part of this is the first part of step one. When drinking and using, I have little control over the amount I take. Guess what? Welcome. If that be the case, you are suffering from an illness, which only a new job, a new wife, a new... Oh, wait a minute, it doesn't say that. That's right, you're suffering from an illness that only a spiritual experience will conquer.
Yeah.
I know how excited you are to get out of here and get another job, to get another wife, get another boyfriend. A new place to live? Let me tell you something. Did you drink and use with money in the bank? Did you drink and use without it? Did you drink and use when you had a ride? Did you drink and use without it? Did you drink and use in a relationship? Did you drink and use out of one? What that tells me is that My external circumstances do not control or do not bring about this essential psychic change. But once this change has occurred, wonderful things can happen. I will tell you about that in just a minute. So, step two is really easy, and I don't really have to spend much time on it at all. If lack of power is my dilemma, if I truly accept step one, and lack of power is my dilemma, and a dilemma is a problem that involves a difficult choice, then I better find a power that's going to save my life. And it better be something bigger than a Coke can I can kick across the room, or an ashtray that I can toss it, you know? It's got to be big. It says, it has to be a power by which I can live, because alcohol and drugs are a power greater than me, but I couldn't live by them anymore. And it has to be a power greater than myself. Well, there, I'm out of the picture. Right? And simply, in step two, I'm looking around the room going, wow, that person used to drink and use like I did, and they're not. That's hope. I want that. Tell me what you do. That's all step two is for me. You know? All it was, you know, all step two was for Bill was that he was visited by an old school friend, Abby Thatcher, who was different. And he said, wait a minute, you are worse drunk than I was, Abby. Why are you so different? You're on different footing. Tell me what you did to do that. That's all step two is. Lack of power. You know, and in step three, page 60, it says, you know, to be convinced of A, B, and C, that's very important. A, that I'm an addict alcoholic and I cannot manage my own life. Nope, I can't even manage a decision to stop and walk away from it. And that B, no human power can relieve our addiction and alcoholism. Let me ask you a question. Did the judge make you quit? Did an employer make you stop? Did a boyfriend, girlfriend, any of that? No? Love of your parents, love of your children? You know, what that tells me is that I'm beyond human aid. I'm beyond human aid. So people aren't going to help in this situation. They may love you. They probably don't understand you. But they're not going to help you get sober and clean. And seek God can and will if you sought. Well, how do I seek God? Isn't that the biggest question right there? Well, so my sponsor and I, and by the way, you know, I hear God through my sponsor. Cliff is not my sponsor, but my sponsor is a man with 7 years clean time. He's a drug addict and an alcoholic, and I hear God through him. He told me that if you put your hand in my hand, I'll put it in God's. And that's exactly what he's done. That's exactly what he's done. And if you have problems with that whole, you know, sponsorship thing, you can come see me after this meeting. But, you know, what Lewis told me was that my basic problem is on page 62. Selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my trouble. You know, alcohol is just a symptom of a much bigger problem, which is my selfishness. I'm selfish to the core. Tells me that I'm driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity. I step on my friend's toes and they retaliate. And they hurt my widow feelings. Aw, that's right. Poor me another one. Right? So I get all burned up and sore at these people that I, that I invariably hurt with my selfishness, self-centered behavior. It goes on to say my troubles are of my own making. They arise out of ourself. And an addict alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot. Though you get us to see that, not me. It's all their fault. Right? Right? Good sponsor is going to bring you right back to, what did you do? How did you cause this, you know? How did you do this? So we took that little prayer on page 63. And I got to tell you, I've done this prayer with the women I sponsor. Some of them have broke down sobbing. Some of them have had no real feelings about it at all. They did feel a sense of relief after it was all over with, but you know, it's interesting. I took this prayer and all I knew was I just didn't want to drink and use anymore, and then I was told that it's time to launch on a course of vigorous action. Well, you know, I think it's interesting too, because I do a lot of 1, 2, 3 and these girls are out the door and you never see them again. They want to talk all day about their problems. Oh, and then they want to say, well, yeah, I believe that if what worked for you will work for me. Okay, I'll do this prayer. Okay, well, you know what? Step four is the first thing that requires any work on my part. It's the first step of action, and that's where people are out the door. Let me ask you something. When you were determined to drink and use, did you sit around and think about it, or did you go get it done? I went and got it done. So this is an action step. This is a house cleaning. It says it's time to take inventory of our lives. Look back through our lives. You know, and we list the principles and the people and the institutions that we have a resentment to. Resentment is just resentiment, refeel, whenever that name comes up. A girl that slept with my boyfriend in college, Leslie, her name would come up 20 years later. It would piss me off, you know? So I put down all these people on my resentment list, and then I do the same with sex and harms, and then I do the same with my fears. And we get a good look at it, because let me tell you what, the minute we sit down and I'm taking my little four-step inventory sheets in there, and I'm like, oh, wow, he's going to see, you know, anyone with drinking use after all the stuff that's happened to me. Oh, let me tell you what, he flipped that script right on me. You know, putting out of our minds the wrongs others have done, let's look for your mistakes. Where were you selfish? You know, one of the people on my resentment list was my brother. Why? Because he's a drunk. Why? Because he never shows up to anything. Why? Because he's just lost custody of his daughter, my niece. I may never see her again. Well, you know what he did? You know, selfishness is not getting what you want. What are you not getting out of this? I'm not getting a brother. I want my brother. My brother, but my brother's a drunk. And he's a drunk just like you are, Wendy. Just like you. What do you expect? And what are you going to say to a drunk that doesn't know they're a drunk? You know, of course he's lost custody of his daughter. But did he ever have a choice in becoming a father? No, he didn't. He didn't. That woman he got pregnant decided they were going to be parents, and he had to go along with it. You know, dishonesty. Dishonesty is it's outright lying, but it's also when I'm setting an expectation for somebody that they can't meet. Is it dishonest of me to want a drunk to not be a drunk? Hell yeah. It's also self-seeking if I'm trying to help God out. Self-seeking. Am I being a victim? Am I being a savior? Yeah. Most of my relationships fell in one of those two categories. Fear. I'm not going to get what I want or lose what I have. I'm going to lose my relationship with my niece, even though she's in better parental care than she ever was with him. So I'm in fear about this. I'm also inconsiderate. Because if you can't walk in someone else's shoes, and none of us can, then you're being inconsiderate. So step five was eye-opening, let me tell you. You know, and I love it too, because in that chapter into action, step five, if we skip this step, we're not going to overcome drinking. Crap, there's a promise. If we don't do this, we're going to drink and use again, so there you have it. If I can't get honest with somebody in this world, my sponsor, then I'm screwed. And it also tells me that I'm an actor. Here's what I want you to see, and here's who I really am. Right? And I'm scared to death that somewhere, somehow, I'm going to get caught. So, 6 and 7, you know, 6, I go home, spend that hour with God. Something comes up that I forget to mention. That's when I call my sponsor. All right, you need another hour with God. And then I pray that simple prayer that's on page 76. You know, first time I read this prayer, I didn't think a thing of it. Second time I read it, I noticed that it starts, my Creator. That means I have a Creator, but so does everybody in my life that they're praying to, that's going to solve their problems the same way he's solving mine. I don't have to do anything for anyone to play God in their life. In fact, when I play God, I'm getting in God's way. And probably, you know, ruining a good opportunity. I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. How many of us gave God all the bad stuff? Right? But now you can have the good of me too. In other words, I'm going to show you how grateful I am by going and helping one of your kids. We always pray those foxhole prayers. God, get me out of this. God, get me out of this. If you do this, I'll never be this again. Well, I guess he answered that prayer for you, didn't he? So what are you going to do back? What do you do in return? It says, I pray you now to remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and to my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. That selfishness I mentioned, he has removed that. For the most part, I can say today, when I got one of my girls calling me at 8 a.m., at 2 a.m., come down to the hospital, come over here, I'm helping whenever I can. I do not want to go back there to the way I was. I can say for the most part that my expectations of others has changed too, because this summer I spent with my brother, I wasn't beating him on the head with this, I wasn't pouring his alcohol down the sink, I was loving him right where he was, for who he was, honestly, loving him. I couldn't do that. God did that. You know, I take consideration of others. When a little old couple cuts in front of me on 75, my initial reaction was, you know, driving up to him, you know, giving him some driving instructions. I pray for them. I hope they get wherever they have to go safely. Because maybe they're on their way up to the hospital to see a dying grandchild. How do I know? Right? God changed these things in me because I couldn't do this on my own. You know, the other cool thing is that that actor, I'm not that. I'm going to be the same person down here in this basement as I am up on that porch talking to you after this meeting, as I would be on the stairs, as I would be in the bathroom on the ride home with Jason. This is who I am. And the more time I spend pleasing him and not you, whew, that's a relief. That's a relief. What do I care about a room full of sick drunks and dope fiends and what you think of me, right? Because I know what God thinks of me. I know what he thinks of me. You know, okay, cool, I got more time. Okay, so my first 4-step, I burn, right? Because I don't know what that was going to do. This little kumbaya ceremony I had with the sponsor didn't know what they were doing. My second 4-step I use is my 8-step list, because this is the list of all the people that I'd harmed and whom I'd hold a resentment to, right? Why do the work over? I got this list. Now I'm going to go out to those fellows and repair the damage I've done in the past. This is a scary step for a lot of people. A scary step. One of the scariest things I had to face was maybe some jail time. You know, I'd stolen from this these two little old ladies that owned this business in downtown. I never walked on that side of the street. I'm always over here, you know, for years. For years, I would avoid walking by that storefront. I took money from them. I closed their shop early. I had the keys to the place, right? Because I couldn't miss happy hour. Anyways, you know what my sponsor said? If you are not willing to put the results and everything else in God's hands, all is lost anyways. You're going to drink again. And I knew it was right, and I knew it was something that I had to do. So I went into them, and I told them about what I was doing. I said, you know, I'm on the 9th step, and this is a program of action, and I'm here to right the wrongs, and I stole from you. And I don't really know how much I took, because I really didn't. I don't know. And I said, but here's $20. Can we set up a payment plan? I'd really like to send you, you know, because I got a job. I get to work today. I'm employable. So we did. We set something up. You know, I was so afraid that they were going to call the police and I'd be, but I was willing to do that if that's what it took. And they sent me this note. You know, I love it, and I keep it in my book because it was the hardest amends to make. The book promises this too. The harder the amends, the greater the benefit to us. It's easy to go to mom and dad and say, geez, I'm responsible for causing you harm and for making you worry about me. I'm very inconsiderate and I've been dishonest, and that's okay. You know, just keep doing what you're doing. They just want to see you alive. But you know the other part to that is, keep doing what you're doing is doing this. And that does require some work, y'all. It requires some work. So, yeah. I love this Nancy, and she says, you know, as an employer, one is put in a vulnerable position and must have faith in their personnel as to their sense of responsibility and their honesty. It is disappointing to find someone has betrayed that trust. She says, however, to admit your mistake and to make amends is commendable and so appreciated. I thank you for your monthly payments, and good luck in your sobriety. Hardest amends, most beneficial. Then I get to 10. You know, oh, and by the way, love those promises that we read in the beginning of every meeting. But guess what? Those don't come through osmosis. They don't. They come after taking step 9. See, every step is followed by a set of promises. There's 552 of them in this book. Those on 83 and 84 are just a few of them. They're all over this book. Every time you take a step, you get a promise. And there are also promises for not taking a step. Right? Some are good, some are not so good. But 10, we continue to clean up this mess. You know, in 4, I had to clean up all the wreckage of my past. So in 10, it's like I get to keep the house clean. I get to keep things dusted off and tidy so I don't have to go back through that major overhaul, right? So I call my sponsor. I called Lewis the other day. All right. I'm going over 20 in a school zone. And the cop's a man. How about that? Now, ladies, what have we done in the past? I've been pulled over so many times and never gotten a ticket for it. And you know what I'm talking about. We use our feminine charms, our, you know, eyelashes, bat the eyes, throw the hair back. But officer, I won't do it again, you know. That officer walked up to my window. God would not allow me to pull that off anymore. I took that ticket, said, thank you, sir. Where do I have to pay? Yes, sir. Thank you, sir. And I called my sponsor and I said, you will not believe this. You won't believe this. That was a $130, $40 ticket. He said, yeah, no, I believe it. I believe it. Continue to look for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When these crop up, we ask God to remove them. I gotta tell you another great story, too. Okay, because we're not perfect. So, my fiance has his phone at my house. There it is. Well, he's gonna need that at work. So, I better call him at work and let him know. What was that bitch's name? Right? Just to see if she's in there. She is. And I call Lewis and I'm like, you will never believe this. Got this rock on my hand and then he's got his ex's number in there. I said, well, got what you wanted. I said, well, do I get to go up to him and say anything? Nope. No, you don't. That was dishonest and selfish and you have to live with it. And you know what? There's some things we just have to live with. There's some bad behavior I just get to live with. Suck it up. That was tough. It was. 11 suggests prayer and meditation. Even when I don't want to do it, I do it. Sit my butt in that chair. I read out of 24 hours ahead, and I sit there. And, you know, it gives us specific instructions. You know, we ask for God's, we ask Him to direct our thinking throughout the day, divorce it from self-seeking, selfish motives. Right? We pause when agitated. That's a great gift in this program. I could have probably used it with with Michael's cell phone. All throughout the day, you know, when agitated, we ask for an intuitive thought or action. It tells us that the right thought will come. The right action will come. It does. You know? God, even getting extra change back? I hate that. Oh, I'm... I only gave you a 10. Woo! That's changing on some serious level, isn't it? How many of you would have kept the change? I would have back in the day, no questions asked. You know, it's like if you don't pray and meditate in the morning, that's like skipping your spiritual breakfast and you will feel weak all day long. And I wish I could get into working with others. It is the heart, it's the meat of this program. It is what I just absolutely love. But I can promise you this too. It does say, there's a whole chapter in chapter 7 in working with others and how to do it. I wouldn't do it for years because I was afraid that I'd kill you by giving you the wrong direction. Well, let me tell you, all the direction you possibly need is right in this book. It's right in the book. I'm not making it up. But it says that nothing will ensure immunity as intensive work with other alcoholics. Jason and I just started an NA group. We're the Bridge to Shore group. We meet on Fridays at 7:30 in Dallas. Love to tell you about it. We use this book the same exact way. We just replace drinking with using. It's wonderful. We carry the message at about 3 different places. And, you know, it's just awesome to watch somebody who is so despairing and weak and you know, so full of fear. Now they're going out and kicking ass and helping other people. It's the bright spot of our lives. This is the best thing that's ever happened to me. And I will end on this. It's on page 100. It says, both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. And if you persist, remarkable things will happen. When we look back, we realize that the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands, we're better than anything we could have planned. Remember, your best planning got you right here. So follow the dictates of a higher power and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. If you're sleeping on somebody's couch, if you're without a job, if you're without a life, a wife, what have you, I promise you, if you follow these steps, you will come to that spiritual awakening, and you will know a level of peace and serenity that you have never known before. I promise you. God bless you. Thanks.